From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're lucky enough to have James A. Baker III. Secretary Baker has served as White House Chief of Staff, Secretary of the Treasury, and Secretary of State. What Stradivarius is to the violin and Federer is to the tennis ball, James A. Baker is to politics and diplomacy. Best-selling authors and journalists Susan Glasser and Peter Baker, no relation to Jim Baker, have a new biography on Baker coming out in September. Here's Peter Baker reading a line from that book.
For a quarter century, every Republican president relied on Baker to manage his campaign, his White House, his world. Baker brought them to power or helped them stay there, then steered them through the momentous events that followed. He was Washington's indispensable man.
But don't just listen to Peter Baker or me. Here's what Presidents Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Obama have said about Secretary Baker. For context, President Clinton in this quote is speaking about the Bush v. Gore recount, which Jim Baker led.
Jim Baker has helped lead the charge since he strode into my campaign in his cowboy boots in the summer of 1980. He's taken his licks and earned his stripes. And Jim, if there ever was a Reaganite, you're it. You're a friend whom I will miss. You've been a secret of our success.
Jim worked with our European allies, the Congress, our friends in the Middle East, the Soviets, and countries around the world to achieve our goals. And he stood up for American principles, and in the process, he earned the admiration of the world.
So he had a strong hand going in, but he played it very well. And like I said, I hated it, but he whipped us, but he was good at it.
Also, let me compliment Jim for the extraordinary service that he rendered the country.
Jim Baker has perhaps more senior White House experience than any other living person. He has worked at senior levels for four U.S. presidents, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush, and he was consulted by other administrations. So thanks again for being here.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So your grandfather, James Addison Baker, had a piece of advice to lawyers joining his firm, which was work hard, study hard, and stay out of politics. So you've worked hard and studied hard, but you didn't listen to that last piece. What happened there?
Well, I tell people that in baseball, 666 is not a bad batting average, and I did two out of the three things my grandfather told me. But to be a little bit less facetious about it, I lost a wife to cancer when she was only 38 years of age, but I had a really good friend here in Houston, Texas, who had just gone into politics. His name was George Bush. He was my tennis doubles partner, and he came to me after my wife died and said, you know, Bake, you need to get your mind off your grief and help me run for the Senate. I said, well, that's great, George, except for two things. Number one, I don't know anything about politics. And number two, I'm a Democrat. He said, well, we can change that latter thing. So I helped him. That was 1970. I helped him run for the Senate against Lloyd Benson, who beat him. So that's how I happened to get into politics. My good friend saw it as a way for me to assuage my grief. And he got me in it. I was his Harris County campaign manager on that Senate race in 1970, and from there, I did a lot more other things in politics.
Well, one of the things you're famous for is preparation, focus, and never being at a loss for words. So your father had an important saying about five P's. So what were those five P's?
Well, my dad used to call it the mantra of the five P's. Prior preparation prevents poor performance. And he drilled that into me from the time I was a young man or an adolescent. And it really stood me in very, very good stead throughout all the politics and all the public service that I participated in. But it also stood me in very good stead in the United States Marine Corps, in the law school, and in the practice of law. Because I was never one who would try to wing it. A lot of times you try to wing it, it doesn't fly. By observing the five P's, I was always prepared.
Well, it played off for you. So let's fast forward to the Reagan election, because this podcast is focused on transitions. And there was a very unusual thing that happened in that election, which is you spent basically 5 years trying to keep Ronald Reagan out of office. First, when you were running Gerald Ford's effort, and then later running George Bush's effort. Then he approached you to be chief of staff after you tried to basically defeat him twice. So why would he approach you as chief of staff, and will that ever happen again?
Well, I tell people when they talk to me about this that I don't think it will ever happen again in American politics, where a president-elect will go to someone who has run at least two campaigns against him to be, and beaten him in one of them, to be their White House chief of staff. I don't believe it'll ever happen again. I think it says something about the broad gauge nature of the Gipper. He was looking for someone who knew and understood how Washington worked. You remember, he was coming in right after Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, who was an extraordinarily bright, intelligent person, didn't think he needed anybody in the District of Columbia to tell him how to do things, and he went up there with some young Georgians, Hamilton Jordan and others, and they didn't do a really good job of massaging the city, massaging the interest groups in the city, working with Congress, working with the press and everything. And in fact, right off the bat, they got crossways with the Democratic Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, who referred to Hamilton Jordan, who was Carter's chief of staff, as Hannibal Jerkin. So I was determined that, I guess Reagan was determined, that he wasn't going to suffer that same fate. So he looked for somebody who knew how Washington worked, and I was that person, I guess. But it speaks to the broad gauge nature of the president. He was persuaded, I think, to give that a try by, by Stuart Spencer, who was his political strategist, and Mike Deaver, who was his very, very close aide, almost as close as family. They talked to Nancy Reagan about it and convinced her, and then the three of them spoke to the president. That's how it happened.
Yeah, and Peter Baker's and Susan Glasser's book, they're friends of mine, and they were nice enough to give me a couple chapters on it. I guess Spencer and Deaver had you go on a plane trip with then-Governor Reagan to kind of test you out and establish a relationship between Reagan and you, and that went pretty well, and then he turned to you. So
that's correct. They put me on the campaign plane for 2 weeks. I was working in the campaign. I was the only Republican at that point in time who had run a campaign for President of the United States and not gone to jail. But I was working on the base for Governor Reagan, and they put me on the plane so that I would become acquainted with primarily so the president could take the measure of me and see if he really wanted to try to bring in as his chief of staff somebody who'd been running campaigns against him.
Your chief of staff, and your job is to put together the White House staff. One of the things that you had to do was negotiate kind of an arrangement with Ed Meese, because he was a longtime aide to Reagan, his chief of staff, and you actually negotiated a piece of paper. Tell us about that.
Well, the night of the election, President Reagan said, "Jim, before you go back to Texas, I want to see you." And I said, "Fine, Mr. President-elect." And I went home and I told my wife Susan about that, and she started crying because I think she figured out what was coming. But the next morning I met with the president. He said, "Jim, I want you to be my White House chief of staff." And after I picked myself up off the floor, he looked at me and he said, "But I want you to make it right with Ed Meese, who had been his chief of staff and who was counting on being his chief of staff after he became president. In fact, already had a table of organization drawn up." So I called Ed and I said, let's go to breakfast and talk about this. And we went down there, and we're both lawyers. And I said, "Well, then let's figure out a workable way to divide up the responsibilities in the White House." I had been in the Ford White House, not at full time, but I'd worked closely with him as Ford's campaign chairman. And I knew a little bit about how it worked. And so we sat down and we drew up a one page, or just one page, with two columns, JAB on one side and EM on the other, delineating our what we would agree would be our respective areas of authority and responsibility. And we agreed that the other would have walk-in rights to the Oval Office. And we agreed on those kind of things and just jotted them down. And that was sort of our Bible going forward.
And you did that with classic Jim Baker skill and grace. You gave him cabinet status, and you didn't reserve that for yourself. You gave him authority over policy. But really what you did is you maintained the core levers of power in with yourself in terms of the scheduling, the operation, and the time of the president, which you often said is the most valuable asset.
Well, Ed was very, here, you got to remember this. Ed, while Ed had been Reagan's chief of staff as governor of California, Ed was interested in policy. And he was a wonderful policy synthesizer for the president. He could tell him, he could boil it down to him. Reagan was better briefed sometimes orally than in writing. And Ed was really good at synthesizing policy. So, and he wanted to do policy. And so we agreed that he would have, you know, responsibility for the Domestic Policy Council. The NSC advisor would report to the president through him. He would have cabinet rank, and I wouldn't. Those kind of things. My job was to make sure the trains run on time, and making the trains run on time meant I had to have authority over the congressional relations, press relations, political relations, and operate from the chief of staff's office, which is the biggest office in the West Wing, and the only office is big enough to have large meetings. So we ended up having the meetings in my office. But anyway, it worked well. It really worked out well for the president-elect. It worked out well for me, obviously. And I think it worked out okay for Ed, although he was extremely disappointed at the time not to be named chief of staff. But he was named counselor to the president. He had cabinet rank. I didn't. It worked very well.
Now, how did you, as in President Reagan, as you pulled together the staff, balance between California loyalists and people that had worked on his campaign and Washington kind of insiders and people that you were comfortable with?
We didn't have to balance it. President Reagan told me, he said, I want you to be my chief of staff, and you can staff the White House. I mean, I asked if I could, and he said, yes. And I said, because I know the people that you're going to want around you who can get things done. And he said, you staff the White House. And that was the only real function I had in that transition. I didn't deal with transitioning the cabinet departments or anything else. Ed Meese ran that. I ran the transition in the White House. And President Reagan gave me a carte blanche to hire the White House staff. And I hired a number of people who some of the more hard-line members of the administration thought were inappropriate because they weren't, quote, Reaganites, close quote. But there were people who were pragmatic, like, just like I was, and just frankly like Ronald Reagan was, and people who could get the job done and got the job done for him.
And, I mean, one of the things that's amazing about that is you really set the gold standard for being chief of staff. And now in terms of transitions, because of your work, best practice is for the chief of staff to have that authority to pick the staff, where the transition people focus on the cabinet. And once the president-elect names the chief of staff has control of the White House staff.
I certainly did when Reagan asked me to take the job. And he and I talked about it, and he said, no, no. He said, I want you to get the best people you can get. I didn't have to go through presidential personnel to test them in terms of political loyalty. The same thing was true, by the way, when I took the job of Secretary of State for my longtime friend George H.W. Bush. I had carte blanche to staff the State Department. I never had to go over hat in hand to get the approval of the presidential personnel office.
Right.
because I'd run all of his campaign.
Right.
So if anybody knew who was politically okay, it would be me.
Well, talking about prior preparation prevents poor performance, just over 2 months after Reagan took office, I think it was March 30th, he was shot. And, you know, were you ready for that? Was the administration ready? And how does a chief of staff get ready for something so unexpected so soon after you're in office?
Well, you can't be, you can't be ready for assassination. And we were not any more ready than any other administration would be. You never know when it's going to happen. The contingency plans were plans that Secret Service quickly implemented on the spot there. They had plans. And plan number one was to take the president quickly to a hospital. But they first they were going to head back to the White House because they didn't know he'd been shot. So, no, we didn't have any plans for that. It would be very hard to conceive of a situation where you would have plans. Whether or not we would have done anything differently, my answer to that would be no. Everything seemed to work out pretty well. The president did go to the hospital. He fully recovered. By the next day, he was signing a piece of legislation that I took over to show the world that he was functional, that everything was okay, and he recovered from his bullet wound.
So let's fast forward to Reagan. He gets reelected, and an unusual transition occurs, which also may never happen again, but you swap jobs with the Treasury Secretary, Don Regan. He became Chief of Staff, and you became Secretary of Treasury. How did that happen, and whose idea was it?
Well, it was Don Regan's idea. It may never happen again either, although it conceivably could. But if it happens again, I think the suggestion or the idea will originate with the president. In this case, it originated with Reagan. Don had been the closest cabinet officer to the president. They were both Irishmen. They were both roughly the same age. Reagan had been chairman of Merrill Lynch, and he and Reagan were very close, and Reagan did a good job as Treasury Secretary. But he was very ambitious, and he wanted more power. And the Chief of Staff's job is the second most powerful job in Washington, provided you realize that you're Chief of Staff and not Chief.
Right.
And I'm not sure Don ever realized that because he'd been a principal. I've always said... You ought not to ever put a principal, someone who's been a principal, either in the Congress or in industry or anything else, in that job because the title is Chief of Staff. And you put someone who's been a principal in that job, and they become enamored of the chief part of the title, but not too fond of the staff part. But you're staff. You're staff, although you're Chief of Staff, you're staff, and you're power is strictly vicarious from the president, totally. So it was his idea. He was mad about a leak in the Washington Post. He sent me a letter, I was chief of staff, saying, I hereby resign as Treasury Secretary. He said, please give this letter to the president. I said, oh, you know, come on, Don, get a, you know, take a deep breath. And he was pissed off, and he was fuming at me over the phone. I said, look, just take a deep breath. I'm going to come over there and see you. And I went over to Treasury, and I got him to withdraw his letter. And I patched it up with him. And what he didn't understand was you don't control leaks. Leaks are endemic up there, and particularly out of the White House, because the ship of state leaks from the top, right? So... I got him off of that, and then he looked at me and said, you're tired, aren't you? I said, damn right I'm tired. I said, I've held this job longer than anybody in history that hadn't gone to jail. And he said, well, you and I ought to change jobs. I said, what? He said, we ought to exchange jobs. I said, you better not say that again, because if the president's willing, I may take you up on it. And so I sort of forgot it and went back, and he called me again about it, maybe week or so later. And I said, well, if you're really serious, I said, I'll consider it. And I went back and I talked to Deaver about it. I talked to Dick Darman, my assistant, a very good right-hand man and friend. And I talked to Susan, my wife, about it. And they all thought, well, you know, if something the president wants to see done, you ought to do it. Deaver first took it to Nancy, which she was the director of personnel, really, in the Reagan administration. She was his guardian and his protector. And she said she thought it was a good idea because she knew how close Reagan and Regan were to each other. And we talked to the president about it, and he said, fine, let's do it, and we did it. That's how that happened.
Incredible. Well, let's move to another transition, which is George H.W. Bush gets elected, and I think he's the third sitting vice president ever to become elected, but it was the first time in over 100 years.
First time since Martin Van Buren.
So you moved to become Secretary of State, and you called that transition in your book a hostile takeover.
Yeah, it was.
Andy Card was on this podcast, and he said a transition from one party to another is much easier than a transition from the same party to the same party. So why did you call that a hostile takeover, and why was it so difficult?
Well, it's hard because you've got all these people you've been serving with. They're all good Republicans. They expect to serve in another Republican administration. But you have a new president, and you need to put his imprimatur on the government, which means you need new people, because people are policy, and people have a tendency, it's a human nature, to get stuck in positions that they've long advocated. They're not going to be too quick to want to change. And so that's why I say it was a hostile takeover, because everybody expects to be reappointed. And therefore, it's a little difficult because you got to go to and say, sorry, we're going to change you out. I agree with Andy.
And you pretty much brought all new people into the State Department, the senior levels, really quite capable people like Bob Kimmitt and Bob Zelick and Dennis Ross and people that have gone on after working for you to have distinguished careers as well.
I brought what the press referred to as my plug-in unit.
Mm-hmm.
People that went with me at the White House, went with me to campaigns, then to Treasury, and then to the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
So I took them with me everywhere I went. The model I followed was the same model that Henry Kissinger had, where he staffed some of the upper echelons on the seventh floor of the State Department with people he knew and people he had confidence in, as opposed to career employees that he might not know. But having done that, I had a lot of really good career public servants, foreign service officers, who occupied very senior positions in the State Department. I had the first foreign service officer who ever became Deputy Secretary of State,
mm-hmm.
Lawrence Eagleburger. I had assistant secretaries who were all career people in many of the assistant secretarial slots. So it was only there at the top where I put Bob Kimmitt in as Undersecretary for Political Affairs, but I had Larry Eagleburger, a careerist, over him. I brought Bob Kimmitt in as counselor, that's true. I had Margaret Tutwiler. I had John Rogers, Assistant Secretary for Management, Margaret for Public Liaison. So I brought in my plug-in unit, but I would argue that I didn't foreclose important positions for careerists. And as a matter of fact, when I first came in, there's always a little bit of suspicion and hostility toward a new Secretary of State, particularly because 80% of the people that work in the State Department are careerists. And they know that the political people are there for a short period of time, then they're going to be gone, but the careerists will be there forever. So there's a tendency to suspect that they may not have the best interests of the building in mind. That was the rap on me when I first went in there. But after they found out about my seamless relationship with President Bush, and that because of that, the State Department was going to be in the lead in formulating and implementing foreign policy, they loved it. If you read their memoirs and stuff, you'll see that it turned out very, very well, primarily because of my relationship with the president, which put the State Department in the lead on all foreign policy matters.
Let's talk about a couple of your decisions during your time as Secretary of State. So within the first year, the Berlin Wall falls, the Soviet Union disintegrates, and you and the president made one of the most subtle but important foreign policy decisions in the last 100 years, which was not to take a victory lap, not to dance on the wall, so to speak, when the Soviet Union collapsed. So what led you to that decision? You were criticized at the time, but in hindsight, it was one of the wisest and most important foreign policy decisions of my lifetime.
Well, that wasn't my decision, although I agreed with it 100%. It was George Bush's decision, and he was very, very adroit and knowledgeable in foreign policy. And he knew, I did too, that we still had a lot of business to do with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, and why stick our finger in their eye? It didn't make any sense. We got a lot of grief. You know, you've won the Cold War, 40 years, all these 40 years, blah, 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 blah. Why can't you be a little more ebullient or emotional about it? And he took a lot of heat for that, but it was absolutely the right policy. And it was proven by what subsequently happened as we presided over a peaceful end of the Cold War.
Then fast forward a couple more years, Iraq invades Kuwait, and there's this whole buildup. You put together the coalition, there's the UN resolutions. It was really a masterful piece of diplomacy. There was one event which was the president sent you to Geneva to meet with Tariq Aziz, who was the foreign minister. I remember this. I was in college at the time. I'm 54 now. And I remember this press conference where you and Aziz were meeting. You tried to get him to withdraw, and the talks failed.
The message that I conveyed from President Bush and our coalition partners was that Iraq must either comply with the will of the international community and withdraw peacefully from Kuwait or be expelled by force. Regrettably, ladies and gentlemen, I heard nothing today that in over 6 hours, I heard nothing that suggested to me any Iraqi flexibility whatsoever on complying with the United Nations Security Council resolutions.
What I remember sitting there, I was literally in a college, in my college cafeteria watching on TV. I remembered, I have no idea how this man withstands the pressure of this moment. So was that the most pressure-filled moment that you experienced in your 12 years in government?
I'm not sure that it was the most pressure-filled moment, but it was pressure. I began that press conference by saying, regrettably.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute I said regrettably, and that there was a huge gymnasium full of press, and I said regrettably, and before I could say another word, all of the wire service reporters jumped up, ran out of the room to file their stories because they figured that, okay, war is coming. It was pressure filled. It was a 7-hour, I think, meeting. And there, I made it quite apparent that we were not there to negotiate down from a UN resolution saying, get out or we throw you out. I wasn't there to negotiate that. I was there to implement it. And, of course, they wanted to negotiate it. And we went back and forth for 7 hours. But I was under no illusions that they were going to just pick up and leave. I mean, Saddam had made too many mistakes. He was one who always went up to the brink, but never understood quite where the brink was. And I'm not sure they knew how serious we were, although we made it pretty obvious in that meeting and otherwise. So it was a pressure-filled moment, but I don't know whether it was the most or not.
Okay. One of the things that you dealt with when you were chief of staff at the Reagan administration was the first national security team that Reagan had didn't really work together very well. They had, you know, Richard Allen at the NSC and General Haig at State and Cap Weinberg at the Pentagon. In the Bush administration, really, they had perhaps the best foreign policy team of any modern president, maybe of ever. You, Brent Scowcroft, and Dick Cheney. So did your Reagan experience and the kind of dysfunction of the Reagan national security team affect the way that you and President Bush put together your team?
Yes, 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 it did, very much so. And it did because it affected the president put the team together with my help in terms of advice and stuff. But one of the things we made sure of was that we went with people who were all friends with each other and who had served with each other in other government jobs. And that's one of the reasons we work well together. And I've often said that I think that 41's national security team was the way the national security team ought to work. We were the exception to the rule. If you go down every other administration, you'll see all sorts of backstabbing and infighting and leaking on each other and everything on the part of the national security apparatus. But George Bush knew how his national security apparatus was intended to work, and he saw to it that it worked that way. Part of that was getting people whose competence was unquestionable, but who were friends and who had been known to work together in past iterations. That's one reason I think we were so successful. We had great leadership, and we were all friends. You know, I don't think the secretaries of defense and state are always juxtaposed against each other because of the nature of their jobs. But I don't think Dick Cheney and I ever took more than two or three issues to the president for resolution. We worked them out with Brent Scowcroft in his office on our Wednesday morning breakfast.
Well, let's fast forward to another election you were deeply involved in, another transition, which was the Clinton to Bush election in 2000. So you were in charge of the recount, which was a very, very difficult time for our country. And I recently, everybody wants to know what's going to happen in this upcoming election. Are there going to be problems? You know, we're going to have another issue. And I recently asked a very prominent Democrat who served at the top levels of the White House, well, what happens if there's a recount in this election? And he said, well, whoever runs it for Biden needs to act more like Jim Baker than Warren Christopher. And so obviously you had a legal strategy, but a big part of what you did was a public relations and a communications strategy to project that Bush was the winner, which obviously the Supreme Court ultimately decided. But can you just describe how you approached your communications and outreach strategy during that turnkey?
Yeah, I will. But guess what? We weren't just projecting that Bush was the winner. He was the winner. And that's the point we made over and over and over again. They had a wonderful slogan, count all the votes. Well, that's true. Nobody can argue against that. But our argument was, wait a minute. The votes had been counted, or by the time Florida was over, they'd been recounted over and over and over again. I always told people, we didn't go down. We didn't contest that election. George W. didn't contest that election. Al Gore did. I went down there to preserve a result, not to change a result. And I think one thing that was important, one mistake I think the Democrats made, they made a couple of big mistakes. Number one, they didn't realize that it was not just a legal contest, but a political contest, and it needed to be treated that way. The other mistake they made was to insist upon recounts in only four Florida counties that were big Democratic counties. Well, that gave us the moral high ground to say count every vote, but you don't want to count any of the state that didn't go for your guy. And those were fundamental mistakes. But the biggest one was that we saw it for what it was, which was a political exercise in addition to a legal exercise. And another thing that we did right was to shut down any commentary from our side except what I would say at the press conferences that I would hold periodically. We had message discipline. On the Gore side, any time a TV reporter would stick a microphone in somebody's face, they would talk. And it didn't matter who it was, whether it was a surrogate for the Democrats or whether it was David Boyd, one of the lawyers, or somebody else. Those were the reasons I think we won. But the main reason we won is because we won the election. And the press went in there after the recount, you know, and did their own recount. Both the New York Times and the Miami Herald, and under all the scenarios they could come up with, Bush was the winner.
Well, this Democrat, I think, still wishes that they used the Baker strategy, and that was the point of his point. So let me, you've been very generous with your time. Let's close with a lightning round, okay? So I'll give you a question and maybe a one-word answer, okay? You ready?
I normally don't do these things, but go ahead.
Okay. So who was the most impressive American politician you ever met?
Well, I don't answer that question because I worked for five presidents, and I never draw distinctions between the presidents I worked for. People used to say, what was the difference between 41 and 43? What was the difference between Reagan and 41? I say, look, I don't do windows. I don't do floors, and I don't compare the presidents I worked for.
Okay. Let me try a different question. Who was the most impressive foreign leader you ever met or worked with?
Well, I think a very impressive foreign leader was Mikhail Gorbachev. I think we'll be treated well by history because he refused to use force to keep the empire together the way all other Soviet leaders had. Of course, I worked with a lot of really impressive foreign leaders. Margaret Thatcher was a very impressive foreign leader, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Hafez Assad was, in his own way, an impressive foreign leader. He was a total dictator, autocrat, and hard line. 9 meetings with him in order to put together the Madrid Peace Conference. But even the Israelis would tell you, while he's hard to get to agree to anything, if he agrees to it, he'll keep the agreement. And as it turned out, he did. Those were all very impressive leaders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who was someone who early in your career gave you wonderful advice and mentorship to help you become who you are?
Well, my father.
Mm-hmm.
One. I had a pretty good sounding board in my wife, Susan,
mm-hmm.
during those years in government. When I would be faced with a particular problem, I'd come home and bounce it off of her. And more often than not, she'd find the answer, and it would be the correct answer.
Which of your many foreign policy accomplishments would you say is the greatest one of your accomplishments?
Well, let me talk about my public service accomplishments.
Okay, please.
Change the question a little bit. When I left office in 1993, January of 93, Doonesbury did a cartoon, and I was the subject of the cartoon, and it recited the jobs that I had done, that is, I had run 5 campaigns for president, I had been chief of staff to 2 presidents, I had been Secretary of the Treasury. I had been Secretary of State. In the last segment, it said, but his most significant accomplishment in public service is that he did all those things and all those years in Washington, D.C., and he left unindicted.
Mm. Well, that is a great accomplishment, but I think you're being modest because, you know, as I prepared for this with my own version of the five P's, I would say that you are the most accomplished senior person to ever work in Washington. If you think about it, you and George H.W. Bush were the only people that were at the top of the Reagan administration. And at the end of the 12 years, you were the only people still there at the top of the Bush administration. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your service. Thank you for being on this podcast. I want to close with a speech that you gave, a eulogy, which brought tears to my eyes and most importantly, brought tears to your eyes. But so we'll close with that. But thank you very much for being here, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me. And I thank you for those comments, but I would suspect you're biased.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
And so I conclude these remarks with his words, written some years ago to his old tennis buddy. "We have known each other a long time," he wrote to me. "We have shared joy and sadness. And time has indeed gone swiftly by. Now it races on even faster, and that makes me treasure even more this line of William Butler Yeats about where man's glory begins and ends, namely with friends. My glory is I have you as such a friend." To which I reply, on behalf of his friends here today, across America and throughout the world, "We rejoice, Mr. President, that you are safely tucked in now and through the ages with God's loving arms around you. Because our glory, George, was to have had you as our president and as such a friend."
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.